Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 2:04 p.m. Monday, March 19, 2018. Before we begin, I want to thank Brian Glenn, the House Judiciary Secretary, who's making sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Max Stanley from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Ledoux, my Vice Chair, Representative Chris Tompkins, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 355, Fire, Forest Land Crimes, Fire Prevention, sponsored by Representative Guttenberg. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. I'd recognize that Representative Stutz has also joined us. To provide a brief recap of the last meeting on Wednesday, committee members reviewed the bill and the committee opened and closed the public hearing. At this time, I would like to take up amendments to House Bill 355. But before doing so, I'd like to put on record that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill. The amendment process will be treated like floor amendments. The maker of the amendment moves the amendment and speaks to it with a three-minute limit. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. Then we will proceed to discussion with each member limited to 3 minutes, and finally the maker of the amendment will have 1 minute to wrap up. When we come to an amendment, the mover can either move the amendment or it will be withdrawn. We will not roll amendments to the back, and we'll begin with amendment number one. Representative Kopp, may I have a motion for amendment number one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one.
Object.
Representative Kopp, tell us about amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We heard in testimony a concern with respect to section 3. We'll direct your attention to page 2 of the bill, line 14, where it talks about entry of an officer or employee of the United States or the state that would be enforcing this section. It says, when responding to a wildland fire or suspected fire or administering the provisions of this chapter, enter upon any land, whether publicly or privately owned. And the testifier raised the issue of an officer entering private land with the idea that they could be responding to more than just a wildland fire, which seemed to be the overall purpose, but the language here is or suspected fire. So he thought, would that include even a campfire or any other small controlled fire? And truly, if we're wanting to emphasize the danger of wildland fires and wildland enforcement, what this amendment would do is, following the word suspected, we would insert the word wildland to provide clarity that this section is referring to wildland fires for the purpose of prevention, control, suppression of why someone would enter property. It's in respect to wildland fire investigation and control, not to any other range of fires that's maybe a very legitimate personal a use that a property owner could have going on his property. So I think it addresses maybe some constitutional concerns and gives a little more protections to landowners. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a quick inquiry. I see the staff from Representative Guttenberg is here. Is the sponsor support or oppose this amendment, the sponsor of the bill?
I believe, through the chair, I believe Representative Guttenberg is supportive of this amendment.
Questions to Representative Kopp? Hearing and seeing none, is the objection maintained?
No, I withdraw my objection, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is approved unanimously. That brings us next to amendment number two. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I move amendment number two.
Object, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. We heard from a number of different sources that there was no intent to apply the provision of current law, which requires an individual to disclose to a peace officer the fact that they have a concealed weapon. And what this amendment does, and all that this amendment does, is that it makes clear that that provision of law is not going to be applied to fire service officers. So there should be no confusion going forward over whether or not an individual is required to declare that they have a concealed weapon when interacting with a fire service officer, even though under this bill, those fire service officers in some cases do have the title of peace officers. So it pulls those two types of peace officers separately and deals with them separately.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. From Representative Guttenberg's office, did you have a position, or did you want to hear from the Department of Law on this matter?
Through the chair, can we hear from the Department of Law?
I understand Aaron Peterson from the Department of Law can advise of the administration's perspective on this amendment. Mr. Peterson, are you available?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
If you can address the department, the administration's perspective on proposed amendment number 2.
So I can do that through the chair, Representative Eastman.
And are you on a regular phone or on a speakerphone?
I'm sorry?
Are you on a speakerphone or a regular handset?
It's a speakerphone. I can pick up the handset.
The audio gets much better when you're not on a speakerphone.
Sure. I'm now on a handset. So current definition of peace officer under, and this is Aaron Peterson for the record again, it's 1181-900 sub 45, and it actually would extend to the peace officer. It actually specifically says all offenses, extends to all offenses or as limited to a specific class of offenses or offenders. So if it is the intent of the legislature to exclude fire prevention officers from this particular statute, the requirement that people, you know, declare that they have a firearm, for example, concealed on their person when they make contact, then this amendment would do that. It would likely be necessary at the risk of causing some confusion among, you know, people out in the field about who they have to or who they'd be required to declare that weapon to. That's sort of a, you know, an issue for consideration, but from a purely legal perspective, this amendment would likely be necessary to exclude fire prevention officers from or exclude people from reporting to a fire prevention officer that they have a concealed weapon on them.
And is Representative Guttenberg's office supporting this amendment or opposing this amendment?
Through the chair, we are opposing it.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Thanks for being available today. If what I'm just asking for your understanding of the law now, if a homeowner is contacted by any recognized peace officer according to current statute, and they're contacted on their own property, is there a duty now to disclose that they're carrying concealed if they are carrying concealed in their own home or on their own property outside the house?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, this is Aaron Peterson. There is case law on that specifically. I don't know off the top of my head. I would have to get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions with regard to this amendment? Do you need a at ease, Representative Kopp?
At ease, please.
Take a brief at ease. Back on record, Representative Kopp, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It appears that the law won't be able to get back to us probably in a timely matter on this amendment. I think the courts have ruled that in your own house or on your property there is not a duty, but because we can't find it right now, I certainly support the spirit of the amendment. So I'll be supporting it.
Mr. Peterson, how long would it take you to find out the answer to the question Representative Kopp has raised about whether or not the case law says that there's no duty to disclose a weapon on your own property or in your own home?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. When you were talking, I got a recorded voice saying that my line was unmuted, and I missed the middle of your question.
That's okay. How long would it take you to get an answer to the question Representative Kopp has posed, which is whether case law already protects a homeowner or property person in possession of the property to the ability to not disclose possession of a firearm when they're on their property to a law enforcement officer?
Sure. So
the question is, how long do you need to research that?
Right. Mr. Chairman, it'll just take a few minutes here. I'm actually going to look it up right now.
Okay. So what we're going to do, we're going to hold amendment number 2 so that you can have a few minutes to get back to us to the question that Representative Kopp raised, and I do want to hear that answer before we take up this amendment. Representative Kopp.
Mr. Chairman, and one other clarification we may want is, does this amendment apply to both public lands, if you're contacted out on public land, and also on private property, your own private property? That's one thing I'm trying to determine, is how inclusive is it?
Did you hear Representative Kopp's additional question?
I did.
Okay, if you could be prepared to answer both those questions when we come back to amendment number 2. So we're going to hold amendment number 2 for now. We will come back to it. Next, we'll take up amendment number 3, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I move amendment number 3.
I'll object, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And this is going to be on page 2, lines 14. And what we are dealing with here is the right of anyone who is doing any of these listed activities to enter private property and then perform a service there with or without the notification or permission of the property owner. And I think that is a very important and weighty thing to think about before we do that blindly. So what I am suggesting is that we better tailor what it is that someone who would be entering private property without permission be able to do. And so in this case, the current language is when responding to a wildland fire or suspected wildland fire or administering the provisions of this chapter. And this chapter is quite broad. And I believe that what we ought to be doing is simply saying that when you are actually in effect responding to a wildland fire or suspected wildland fire, then you do have the go-ahead to enter someone's private property and take care of that fire or suspected fire. However, administering the provisions of this chapter is overly broad, and I think you're going to come into situations where that is not what, in fact, we want these individuals to do or be doing. And I've had some concerned members of the public contacted me and expressed this, especially since there are times when individuals who may be temporarily employed doing these types of activities on a seasonal or other basis with minimal training. And the concern wasn't dealing with the training, but the concern was if we're expecting that these are full-time members of the fire service, that's one thing, but I don't think that expectation would always be proven true. And unfortunately, there have been cases in the local area where individuals have used these permissions to enter private property and have gone about their business and then left, and then a short while later, private property from that same area ends up disappearing. And so there's a concern that if we have people who are in a private property and seeing things they otherwise wouldn't be able to see, and some of it comes missing later, that we want to prevent, any...
Thank you, Representative Eastman. That's your 5 minutes. Does the sponsor of the bill support amendment number 3 or not?
Through the chair, we oppose it. This was actually an amendment done in the Natural Resources Committee with Representative Rauscher. It was kind of a compromise to be a little bit more specific of when we can enter land. Prior to this, it was at any time, and we added the when responding to a wildland fire or suspected fire or administering the provisions of this chapter to be a bit more specific. I would like to defer any other questions to the department, please.
So, let's get Mr. Mache on the phone to provide more detail, and then we can direct questions. Mr. Mache?
Yes, hi. This is Director Mache, for the record, and to the chair. We did discuss this particular measure for our Mountain House Resources, but I'll recap the key points. In no way does individuals' criminal rights for search and seizure stop from this section of this particular statute. There's also, of course, their constitutional rights. And then as necessary, if it's after the fire, so it's not control or suppression of the fire, a warrant is required if we do not have the permission of the landowner to enter the property to determine cause and origin of the fire, which are two key aspects our FPOs are trained to do. So we feel this language is necessary for our staff to properly do their charge.
Representative Ledoux.
All right, so I'm a little bit confused here. So what exactly would be administering the provisions of this chapter? And where does it say that a warrant would be required?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that a warrant is required if we suspect a criminal charge may be pending based on the investigation. My officers are trained. They're not badge-carrying or gun-carrying officers, peace officers, as this statute describes, which I think we'll discuss later. They can only enforce the provisions of this chapter, which are the safe burning practices, that are in regulation and statute, which also includes determining cause and origin of all wildland fires, which requires a fire investigation. Sometimes those investigations can be completed at the time the suppression action is going on. Other times it has to be after. And so those four items I outlined are always in place in other parts of the statutes the state of Alaska has.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
Well, I guess I'm still not seeing where it says that a warrant is required. So I guess I'd like to ask somebody from the Department of Law, when they read this Section 3, which talks about, when we're talking about what we're talking about, and also the word investigating, whether or not a warrant is required, or whether this supersedes other law requiring a warrant.
So we have two folks from the Department of Law. We've got Aaron Peterson, who's more in the criminal division, and then Ann Nelson in Department of Law, who I assume is more connected with the timber or with the forest management part. Ms. Nelson, can you answer Representative Ledoux's question?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Ann Nelson with the Alaska Department of Law. Representative Ledoux, the requirement for a warrant is a matter of constitutional law, and there's nothing in the statute that would supersede that or even purport to supersede that. So the warrant requirement is a constitutional, U.S. constitutional and Alaska constitutional requirement that still applies and overlays all statutes that are on the books, including this one.
Follow-up?
Okay, so as I understand it, if they are responding to a suspected wildland fire, they clearly don't need a warrant, right?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, in exigent circumstances, that authority is a little bit broader. And the investigating that the fire prevention officers typically do is related to the cause and origin of the fire, so because that's valuable information they need to develop suppression tactics and actively fight the fire. When it comes to criminal liability, that investigation is typically done under the direction of the troopers and the criminal side of the Alaska Department of Law.
But the investigation isn't done under the auspices of the Department of Law?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the initial investigation as to the cause and origin of the fire is often done in the field in the during the initial attack of the fire by forestry, by the fire prevention officers. If it looks as if there's a question of criminal liability, that investigation is done under the auspices of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law and the Alaska State Troopers and regular law enforcement.
Just one further question. So if all of this stuff about administering the provisions of this chapter or investigating the criminal liability, if all of that is done under the Department of Law, why do you need, with a warrant and so forth, why does this need to be in the statute? Why shouldn't it just say when responding to a wildland fire or suspected fire, and take out administering the provisions of this chapter and also take out investigating?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in addition to the criminal provisions in this chapter, in this bill, there are also a number of provisions that address what we call bail schedule offenses or the and enforcing the permit program that the Division of Forestry currently administers. So this right of entry would actually enable them to follow up on permits that have been issued, to follow up on complaints that burning is being conducted either in violation of a permit or on a day when the burning is closed statewide.
So wouldn't that be a criminal thing, which has to be under the Department of Law anyway?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, not necessarily. This bill authorizes in Section 21, authorizes the Supreme Court to publish a schedule of bailable offenses, which are akin to parking tickets that a person can pay in complete satisfaction of the offense without having to appear in court. And
right, but why?
Follow up.
I still don't know why the investigation and the administering of all of this wouldn't be under the Department of Law.
Well, Representative Ledoux, I think, let me ask a question of the isn't part of the issue about investigation, if you've actually got something burning, separate from whether there's actually an investigation going on, part of investigation in fire prevention is actually trying to figure out where the fire started so you can actually put the fire out, and if you have to go out for a warrant as part of your investigation of where's the smoke coming from, you actually could be putting significant danger to property by going to the courthouse and trying to get a warrant when, in fact, what you're trying to investigate is why is there smoke and where did the fire start and trying to put it out. I may be getting that confused, but Ms. Nelson, if you can clarify, because I know this Section 3 is specific to employees of the Division of Forestry, and so it's a fairly narrow number of people who actually have this authority, but is an investigation when a fire is actually, when smoke is going on, different from a criminal investigation?
Through the chair, that is correct. They're investigating has a number of meanings in terms of the Division of Forestry's fire program.
And does that provide any further follow-up, Representative Ledoux?
Well, it would seem to me, and I know that we're past the time for amendments, but that the very term investigating should have some parameters. So we know that they're actually investigating something so that they can figure out where the fire is, rather than just investigating like a criminal thing.
Mr. Mache may be able to provide some insight into that, what the range of conduct that's involved in investigating. Mr. Mache?
Yes, for the record, this is Chris Mache, Director of the Division of Forestry, through the Chair, Representative Ledoux. And the conversation has been a good one with regard to the term investigating. There are different times and needs for investigation of a fire. It's very clear that when we have a smoke report, we often have to cross numerous pieces of private property while we're investigating that smoke report to determine if there is actually a fire. So that, in one sense, is investigating that report. Another type of investigating is once we have located a fire is to determine the cause of that fire, what was the ignition source, and then also the origin, what property is it located on. That's a more formal investigation that my staff are highly trained to do because a fire investigation is a fairly complex effort, but it is solely focused on cause and origin. If it does look like it leads to a charge under the statutes, then that's where it gets the state fire marshals or the state troopers involved.
Mr. Mitch, are you on a speakerphone or on a regular handset?
I'm on a cell phone, so I apologize. I don't have a better set available.
You might speak a little bit slower. I think when you get talking faster, it's harder to follow. If you could explain a little bit more what you were just saying. Or actually, Representative, did you have a follow-up, or do you want a little slower explanation?
I just want a slower explanation, please.
If you want to kind of finish up the last little bit and explain a little more detail about the range of investigations.
Yes, let me repeat that. I apologize for the difficulty in hearing me. So the two types of investigations that are easiest to describe would be when we have a smoke report, and we often have to enter numerous pieces of private property to determine whether there is a actual fire or not. So it may be just walking across a piece of property until we determine there is fire or not. The next type of investigation is when we have located a fire, we will actually do a formal investigation to determine what was the origin of the fire, in other words, whose property is it on, and then what was the cause of the fire, how did the fire actually ignite. And that can be a fairly extensive investigation, which my enforcement officers are highly trained in making determinations of cause and origin. If that investigation looks like a charge should be made against the private landowner for violation of the statutes, we involve either the state troopers or the state fire marshal's office with that aspect of the investigation.
Follow-up?
So it looks like, unless I'm misunderstanding this, that you could do all sorts of expensive investigating under this proposed statute, investigations that might lead to criminal charges, and you can do all of this without a warrant? Is that you're viewing this?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, certainly in the early stages of the fire when we're trying to determine if it is when we're suppressing or controlling the fire, that is the early stage of investigation, again, for cause and origin. After the fire is controlled, if we think the investigation will lead to criminal charges, we do involve the troopers or the state fire marshals. We often get permission from the landowner at that point to enter the property, but if we need to secure a warrant, that will be done through law enforcement, not through my staff.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And through the chair, a series of questions. Can you please explain to us what a destructive agent is?
Mr. Mage?
Yes, through the chair, destructive agent is actually defined in the definition section, and I don't know if you have one of the orange books handy. It's the one that we've passed out to several members. It's our shorthand book for all these different statutes.
And Mr. Mish, slow down a little bit. Your cell phone makes it hard to hear when you talk too fast.
Yeah, sorry again.
It's okay.
Turn to section 41.15.170. It's the definition section in the orange book that we have passed out to some of the members. And destructive agent is defined there, item 2, and that means an insect, pathogen, or other environmental agent that causes damage to a forest resource.
Follow-up?
Yes. So while someone is controlling this destructive agent, based on the construction of this bill as presently written, would they need a warrant or any kind of permission to be able to do that on someone's private property, or could they go ahead and do that without notifying the person who owns that property?
I'll respond through the chair, Representative Eastman. Best example would be bark beetles. You might be familiar with that if you're from the Kenai or the Matsu. An insect that can kill large tracts of trees and then create a fire hazard from the dead material that's the result. Through other regulations, we have the Commissioner of the Natural Resources can establish a zone of infestation and then actions which include the best interest finding. And then emergency regulations can be put in place to deal with destructive agents. So this was initially created in 1961, and since that time, under the Forest Practices Statute, additional regulations have been developed to deal with destructive agents. But this does give us that right in conjunction with the other activities I just described.
Follow-up to clarify. So what was the answer to my question, I guess? My question was, if you are going to administer the provisions of this chapter to control a destructive agent, in this case maybe an insect, is there any requirement under this bill as written to notify the private property owner, or is that something that is kind of optional?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the property owner would have to be notified, but those sections are addressed in the state's forest practices statutes.
And follow-up?
Sure. I would note that this particular section is about the right to enter to control and suppress fires, and one of the factors is the destructive agents become a factor in whether what's burning, but it appears in this section that this section would not give authority to go in to deal with suppression or issues just because there was a destructive agent. It's the combination of a fire that a destructive agent is involved, but go ahead and follow up, Representative Eastman.
Well, and that is the question, though. The language that I'm seeing is, or controlling a wildland fire or a destructive agent, and we are now opening that up to be anyone who is administering any of the provisions of this chapter. My question to the department is the fact that you can't go onto someone's property without notifying them, is that found somewhere else? Because I don't see any requirement for notification in this statute, so are we drawing on another statute to reach that conclusion?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's correct. It's 41.17, Forest Practices Statutes, and I briefly outlined that process that the Commissioner of Natural Resources would follow. Zone of infestation would be declared. That's through a best interest finding. Emergency regulations would be put in place. And if a landowner did not comply with those regulations, this section 4115 would give us the authority to enter and deal with the destructive agent.
And follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
So to go back to, I think, a statement made earlier, so in administering the provisions of this chapter, the reason that we need this expanded scope of administering the provisions of this chapter is because we would want to go onto someone's private property to issue them a citation of some kind, and if we don't have this permissive language in here, we would have to do something else, get a warrant or whatnot, because we wouldn't have the permission to enter onto that private property.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I did not follow your question there. Could you repeat that, please?
Certainly.
Again, Representative Eastman.
So going back to what was stated in answer to a previous question, so the reason, as I understand it, that we need this broadened scope of administering the provisions of this chapter as opposed to just responding to wildland fire, suspected wildland fire, is because we have these bail schedules part of this part of this bill. We want to be able to issue citations and so forth. And in order to enter someone's private property to issue them a citation, we need this broadened scope to be able to enter the property. Otherwise, we would have to go about it a different way and get a warrant or something. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I wouldn't interpret it quite the way you just phrased it. If someone's committed a criminal act, law enforcement would have the right to enter that property to issue that ticket or charge. To administer the provisions of this act are the things we had previously discussed, which is either to suppress the wildland fire, investigate whether there is an actual fire upon a smoke report or other complaint, and then to determine the origin and cause of the fire through an investigation, which can occur at the time of fire or after the time of control of the fire.
And follow-up?
Quickly, Representative Eastman.
So now if we were talking about, say, a residential fire, and someone was responding to that residential
Representative Eastman, this section, including amendment number one, is only responding to wildland fires and suspected wildland fires.
Yes,
so Representative Eastman, you need to limit your question to wildland fires.
I will limit it to 1 minute. I do need to explain, Mr. Chairman. So to continue, if we were dealing with a residential fire,
Representative Eastman, we're not dealing with
residential fire. Yes, I'm making a contrast,
fire.
Mr. Chairman, and it's important that I make that contrast.
Go ahead.
So as contrasted, when we were responding to a residential fire, we wouldn't need a warrant or this type of provision because, as I understand it, responding to such a fire already includes with it, once you're in control of the fire scene, you can investigate that without getting a new warrant. But at the time that you cease to have control of the fire scene, a warrant would be needed to go back onto the property. Is that similar in this situation to the right to have that investigation without a new warrant, or is something different going on here?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't believe anything different is going on, whether it's a structure or a wildland fire. As I've said before, we, after the fire is controlled, we have permission to continue the investigation from the landowner. We do that. If we suspect the investigation could lead to criminal charges, we involve the state troopers and the state fire marshal's office, and they will seek a warrant if that is appropriate for the circumstances. I don't see that there's a difference between how a structure or wildland fire would be treated as you've described it.
Thank you. And final follow-up?
Final one.
So I go back to maybe asking you to make clear for the committee, if something criminal was discovered or suspected, you would have to go and get a warrant. If you're, you know, leaving the property and you're no longer in control of it, you want to come back later, you know, normally you'd have to get some kind of warrant. What is it that makes this permission to enter onto the land, why do we need it? If we've already got these other avenues to cover it and we're already going to use them if there's anything criminal suspected, why do we need this authority for each of these individuals to go onto private property?
That, again, is a requirement when we are trying to determine whether there actually is a fire or not from a smoke report or other reported fire that comes in from neighbors. Could be aircraft often report fires. Then our job to determine where that fire is located. So we often cross significant amounts of private property and the investigation of that smoke report. That's essentially what this chapter does. It gives us that authority to enter that property.
Thank you. Any further discussion of amendment number 3?
This discussion?
I think we're in discussion because I don't see any more questions. Representative Kopp, discussion.
So, Mr. Chairman, exigent circumstances apply to both municipal firefighting, wildland firefighting, and as you know, Mr. Chairman, that is an exception to the warrant requirement because of the fantastically destructive potential of fire, which is why if there's a burn ban in a municipality or in a rural borough, and you happen to have anything going on in your backyard, and the fire department shows up, you will know the fire department is there when they're pulling hoses around the side of your house, not when they're knocking on your front door. And the reason why is they're there to put out the fire, and they ask questions later. And there's exigent circumstances that apply because of the well-documented catastrophic loss of fires. So we all know the Sockeye fire. I mean, we could go back. Alaska is replete with horrific fires, and why fire service agencies have to respond quickly. Representative Eastman, I think he asked a good question when he said, you know, once the scene is secure and you find something criminal, would you then go and get a warrant? And I appreciated the fire director's answer that, yes, we would. And that's what they do now, both municipal and with the state forestry. It's always been my understanding. And I think as far as administering the provisions, that would also, in my mind, including issue citations. So if you're there, you put out the fire. Part of administering is the civil action of issuing a summons or a citation. And there is nothing in the law now that would require a police officer to go get a search warrant to go back to someone's house or to find them on their land to simply issue them a citation. You can go back to that person and issue them a citation. So it appears that it's consistent with the exceptions to the search warrant requirement now that apply to the fire service when they're in the active response mode. And I would love to hear from the Department of Law, but that's my take on it, is that we are just putting basically in statute what the practice is, and I believe it's a sound one constitutionally and legally, or I should say constitutionally and practically speaking as far as the firefighting goes.
Thank you. Any other discussion of amendment number 3? Is the objection maintained, Representative Preston?
Yes.
Representative Eastman in wind up.
Thank you. So the section is titled Right of Entry to Control and Suppress Fires, and I think that's exactly what the section should be about. Currently, as written, it's about more than that. It's about responding to a wildland fire, suspected fire, or administering the provisions of this chapter, which deals with things like constructive agents and other things. We already elsewhere in this section are giving people the opportunity once they're on the land to suppress and prevent and control and do all the sorts of things that firefighters should be doing. And I think that's where the line should be drawn. The idea that someone can, when they're not responding to a fire or a suspected fire, enter onto somebody's land to administer the provision of this chapter and to write citations and those sorts of things, I don't think that's a good idea. If they're responding or they have responded or maybe they're coming back from responding, fine. But for them to enter onto private property when there is no fire or suspected fire and then start writing citations on somebody's private property when they haven't asked permission.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. That's your minute.
You could call the roll.
Representative Reinbold, not present. Representative Kopp.
No.
Representative Stutes.
No.
Representative Ledoux.
Yes.
Representative Kreis Tompkins.
No.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
And Chair Klayman.
No.
That's two yeas and four nays.
So by a vote of 2-4, amendment number 3 has failed. At this point, let's... Oh, brief at ease. We'll turn back to amendment number 2 and see if Mr. Peterson has had a chance to answer the two questions that we had on amendment number 2 before we set that briefly aside. Mr. Peterson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Aaron Peterson, Department of Law. So I don't believe there are any exclusions for being in your dwelling, for example, specifically with respect to informing a peace officer that you're concealing a deadly weapon. In that same statute, 1161.220, there is an affirmative defense for being in your dwelling or on land pertinent to the dwelling for other offenses under that same statute, but not for, informing the peace officer that a person has a concealed weapon, and that's an officer safety issue. That's why it's in statute. So,
why can you explain why what is in statute?
Land. I'm sorry?
You said why that is in statute. Why what is in statute?
Why the statute exists. Why 1161.220 A1, the requirement that a person tell a peace officer, hey, I have a concealed weapon on me.
And that's for protecting the officer?
It's to let the officer know the entirety of the situation, and that's why there isn't a statutory exception for where that contact occurs, like there is, for example, for subsection A6, which is for possessing a deadly weapon while being under the age of 21, if some other things apply. But I'm showing that contrast that the drafters of this statute specifically considered that question, private property, and did not add that affirmative defense to the requirement that a person inform a peace officer that they have a deadly weapon on their person.
Representative Kopp, follow-up in response to the...
Does this amendment apply to both public and private land?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, the amendment... It does not appear to have any, it doesn't appear to distinguish between, and certainly 1161.220 does not, for the purposes of A1, the statute that we're talking about, does not have an exception for public land either. So, for example, if somebody's, in the field fishing, right, and they're contacted by a peace officer, they are required to disclose.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Peterson with respect to Amendment Number 2?
Just discussion.
So let's turn to discussion of Amendment Number 2. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought there was one for your own home or property. Because there is not already in the law, I will not be supporting this amendment. And the reason why is for officer safety purposes. I think it's very important that for the safety and protection of our police, if they have a contact with someone in the field, wherever that contact has occurred, they're there on their official duty, that the law now provides that the person disclose if they are carrying a concealed weapon. As the testifier before me said, it is so the officer can know all the facts of the scenario that they're facing, and that law does not require the police officer to take possession of the gun. It just says that the person must notify, and I think it's a very important for officer safety reasons that we not change the law as it is now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion of Amendment Number 2. Hearing and seeing none, is the objection maintained?
Yes.
And wind up, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the amendment here is simply that nothing in this section requires a person to disclose a deadly weapon to a peace officer as defined in this section. And I think what you'll find is if your average Alaskan comes upon Smokey Bear and is talking fire or fire prevention or wildfires, they're probably not thinking that this is a peace officer. And I don't believe that they ever were, you know, intended to, because these are not peace officers that are wearing guns and trooper uniforms and trooper hats. And so there's going to be any number of situations where someone has no idea that this is a peace officer that they're supposed to be declaring weapons to, and so they're probably not going to. And I don't think they should have to, because, again, this is an entirely different concept. These are peace officers performing a very different function. So we should not be requiring this language from our traditional law enforcement to apply to these kinds of special condition peace officers.
Point of order.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Representative Kopp, point of order.
I believe this whole amendment is out of order, because I think we were told very clearly that these persons, for purposes of that definition, do not fall under a peace officer. I think the supervisor, whoever is, said this, that they're not armed. I think he said they're not armed and they're not badged, and that the duty to disclose may not even apply to those persons to begin with. And if that is the case, then I think the amendment is unnecessary. I mean, even by the amendment maker's intent, if that's the case, then it's not necessary to begin with.
Point
I'm
of order.
I'm just unclear on that.
Point of order to point of order?
Yes, point of order is
Representative
simply.
Eastman, you haven't been recognized yet. Well, the
in other words, they're not sworn, Mr. Chairman. They're not sworn peace officers. These are firefighters.
There's a definition that I think we have in the bill about who is a peace officer.
I do need to make a point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman, you can make a statement. I'm not sure until I've ruled on Representative Kopp's point of order that another point of order is appropriate, but you can certainly make it.
Well, I think it's important to correct the record. We did hear testimony in this very hearing that these peace officers, whether they have badges and hats or not, are very much fall under this. In fact, Department of Law testified to that. And so if it's important to remind the committee of that, I think we should get Department of Law again on the phone so that they can re-answer that question, because that question was asked and it was answered.
Mr. Mesh, who is, because I've heard enough from Mr. Mesh on this, and I can't remember where I heard him in which place, so I'm going to get him to answer the question. For the folks that have some, I would call it a limited authority peace officer under the Division of Forestry, what do they look like and what do they carry, and what is your understanding of the scope of their authority?
Does Title 11 apply to them?
Yes, through the chair, Representative. The scope is very narrowly defined. It's Section 4115950, and it's addressed in A, Section A and Section 1 of that section. And they are peace officers by definition, but there's a range of peace officers from, you know, the fully sworn peace officer to the type of prevention officer we have in our division, which are not badge carrying or weapon carrying peace officers.
And if you know, are they subject to Title 11, or do they have authority under Title 11, or is that a question for the Department of Law?
That would be a better question for Ann Nelson from the Department of Law.
Ms. Nelson, are you following our discussion?
To the chair, I was busy hearing that my line was unmuted and missed the question.
Well, we're glad you're on the phone. The query is, does a peace officer so designated under AS 4115950, which is the Public Resources Forest Land section, are they covered within the meaning of Title 11 peace officers that are at issue in Representative Eastman's proposed amendment number 2?
Whether they are or not depends on the enforcement context. The fire prevention officers that work for the Division of Forestry are commissioned by the commissioner in accordance with 4115, I think it's 950A. And pursuant to the definition of peace officer that's in Alaska Statute 0110.060, a peace officer means an officer whose duty it is to enforce and preserve the public peace. So that definition of peace officer definitely applies. It's outside of Title 11.
Follow-up question. Representative Cobb, follow-up.
So, yes, question. The amendment says that nothing in this section, amendment number 2, nothing in this section requires a person to disclose a deadly weapon under AS 1161-220A1A. That's the section of law requiring that you notify a peace officer that you have concealed on your person a deadly weapon, if you do have it concealed on your person. So would this apply to your fire service worker in the field who shows up on your land and you are outside your house, but you're on your land? Would you be, or would it depend on the scope of duty of that fire service worker? We're trying to see if this requirement of notification to a peace officer would apply to the Division of Forestry worker.
Through the chair, Representative Cott, I think the answer to that question turns on whether fire prevention officers fall within the Title 11 definition of peace officer. And I am trying to pull up that document as we speak.
And I'd recognize that Representative Reinbold has joined us. Ms. Nelson, you're still with us?
I am still with
okay.
you. I'm sorry.
Okay,
I'm
just making sure.
My apologies.
No, take your time.
It looks like it may or may not.
Through the chair, peace officer as described for the purposes of Title 11 means a public servant vested by law with a duty to maintain public order or to make arrests, whether the duty extends to all offenses or is limited to a specific class of offenses or offenders. So even though that description is located in Title 11, and the beginning of 1181-900 says that those definitions are for the purpose of, in this title, unless otherwise specified or unless the context requires otherwise. So fire prevention officers would fall under the scope of both of those definitions. However, they don't have general Title 11 enforcement authority.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. Through the chair, maybe to get at the crux of what I think I understood Representative Kopp to be asking, I think his point of order related to, is Amendment Number 2 effectively redundant or unnecessary because such a duty to disclose does not already exist? And so I guess my question, which I think I maybe could make out through the answer series of answers, is such a duty to disclose does not presently exist. Is my understanding accurate?
Through the chair, Representative, in the 10 years that I've been advising the Division of Forestry, I don't know that this issue has ever come up for us to look into, to be honest. I am aware of situations where fire prevention officers have gone to private property to investigate a smoke report or a report that a neighbor is burning and that it looks uncontrolled and dangerous, and they have been met at the bottom of the driveway with by a number of individuals who are carrying loaded weapons. And so there was never a question of whether those weapons would be disclosed. That's just the circumstances of that encounter. And the fire prevention officers are trained to not engage in situations like that, but to back off and avoid the conflict and contact the troopers.
So, go ahead, follow up.
Yep.
Actually, I'll put you in the queue. Representative Ledoux is next.
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, and this is, can I address this question to Representative Kopp?
Yes, absolutely.
Prior to this philosophical or legal discussion as to whether or not these fire officers fall under the definition of peace officers pursuant to AS 11, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it sounded like Representative Kopp wanted to make sure that the existence of a concealed weapon was disclosed. So even if, for example, you determine, which I don't think we're going to do here today, that they don't fall under AS 11, 220, A1, et cetera, would you want to see that the existence of a concealed weapon has to be reported? Is your rationale for reporting it to peace officers, do they fall enough into the peace officer category that you want to make sure that somebody reports this?
I want to make sure we're not undoing current law. So Representative Christ Tompkins was right when he said, is this redundant? I want to make sure if these people are peace officers, if they are, and it sounds like law is not quite sure, then I don't want to undo what the law requires, that they, if they're recognized as peace officers, the law now says if you are carrying a concealed weapon and you are contacted by a peace officer, you must notify them that you are carrying a concealed weapon on your person. That is a very good officer safety law this legislature passed many years ago to protect the safety of peace officers in the line of duty. Now, if this amendment is undoing that, I'm concerned. If they are peace officers, then we're not, then this is kind of a, this amendment is actually going to be undoing what the law requires now, and that's why I wanted to know what their actual status is, because I am not supportive
of undoing our current law, which requires notification to peace officers that you're carrying concealed when they are contacting you in the field.
I understand, but to the individual person who's out there, whether they're designated a peace officer or not, I mean, so let's say they decided that we were just told that these are not peace officers under AS 11, etc. Would you want to see them protected like that or not? Or is the big thing the definition, whether they're covered by AS 11? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is if you've got a good rationale for making sure that they know it, does it really matter whether they're covered now by AS 11? I don't know. Maybe I'm not making myself clear, but I have a feeling that when AS 11 was passed, nobody had considered this because nobody knows the answer to this question. So do you want to see these folks covered or not covered?
I am not favorable of expanding the definition of peace officer beyond what it is now. And that's why I was trying to get at what the definition is, so that we are not unintentionally upending current law with this amendment. Because that's a whole separate public policy question. Once you expand the definition of peace officer, you get into all kinds of questions about benefits, and it opens up a Pandora's box. So we just need to be careful on these types of amendments, that we know what's before us.
And I don't think that we, through the chair, I don't think we have any idea what's before us right now based upon the answers to the questions that we've gotten.
Representative Cupp, I'll put you in the queue, Representative Eastman. Representative Cupp, you are next in the queue. Did you have most of what you said done, or did you need to add a little more?
I think...
Before you, let me just make a comment. Yes. Exercising my life as the chair. The question, I am reminded of two different scenarios. One is when police are executing warrants, and we've seen pictures when they're executing it on houses with drug stuff, they come with these jackets that have police all over it because they want people to know that this is the police coming and they want there to be no mistake. I think in the scenario, the somewhat narrow scenario we're talking about, so there's a fire going on, there's a fire officer who's a designated peace officer pursuant to Title 41, and they don't exactly look like a police officer because they don't have a big blue jacket that has yellow letters that say police, and they're not clearly identified as a public safety officer in what I would call the traditional sense. They've got firefighting gear on and they've got wildland firefighting gear on. That if somebody didn't disclose in that instance because everyone's rushing about to try to fight the fire, I think that person, A, based on what Ms. Nelson has said, is very unlikely to be charged. And part of the reason is that if they were charged, they would have the defense. I had no idea this was a police officer, and that knowledge about whether the police officer would be a prerequisite to charging somebody under 1161-220. So I think that the question that we're kind of banding about is, do we want to weaken the protections we're trying to provide for easily identified and recognized public safety officers? Do we want to diminish those protections that we currently have in the law, or do we want to maintain the status quo? Representative Cobb. Then I have Representative Grice Tompkins and Representative Eastman. Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So we heard testimony that the folks are not badged or either authorized to carry firearms or do, in fact, carry firearms. So it appears that there would be little other than maybe their wildland firefighter gray shirt and green pants or whatever the standard duty is that would identify them as working for the Division of Forestry. The reason why we have this notification requirement in the law is, frankly, to protect uniformed peace officers that are readily recognized as as peace officers from bodily injury and harm, and knowing that if there is a threat present or the possibility of an elevated threat that they would otherwise be unaware of without the notification, is to keep them safe. So that's why I feel like this definition is important, because I certainly, if these people were for all intents and purposes peace officers, then I wouldn't want to deny them that same protection. But I have a very high doubt in my mind that that was the intent of when this statute was adopted by the legislature to extend to these types of folks. But the question is unanswered in my mind, so I'm not clear.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think as Representative Ledoux put it, we don't know what's before us. And in my asking the question of Ms. Nelson, she didn't seem to know either, with all due respect. I mean, it seems like that we're entering sort of an obscure realm. But I think in practice, the question is, do these people who are running up to people's driveways to investigate smoke or potential fire, right now, does the Division of Forestry presently have an expectation that their personnel are going to have the people there, the citizens they're encountering, disclose whether they're carrying firearms or not, yes or no? And I want to pose that same question to Mr. Mache and Mr. Peterson, and I hope one of them can offer some insight.
Start with Mr. Mache.
Yes, this is Chris Mache again, Director of Division of Forestry, through the Chair, Representative. We do not have that expectation. Our officers are very noticeable. They arrive in a lime green truck with typically flashing lights. They have yellow firefighter Nomex shirts, helmets, and shoulder patches, identifying them as a Division of Forestry firefighter.
And so you don't expect them to be getting told, oh, by the way, I'm carrying a concealed weapon?
We do not.
What was your second question, Representative?
Well, my second question was going to be if Mr. Mache didn't have an answer, if Mr. Peterson did, but Mr. Mache does now have an answer, so I feel like I have a little bit more clarity.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So
this is technically a discussion, by the way.
Yeah, understand. And I think this amendment is trying to preserve that same expectation, because this bill is expanding, however slow or far, the definition of a firefighter to encompass things like giving citations that are more typically thought of as police officers. And having worn both uniforms, both police and fire, and having, you know, a wildland firefighter uniform at home that I've used before, I can just say personally for me, speaking for me only, I want to preserve that distinction. When I'm interacting with someone on a fire scene, I don't want them treating me like a police officer. Not anything bad about police officers, but I want them to be treating me like a firefighter, and I don't want them to have to, you know, come up to me and tell me about weapons or anything else. I want to focus on fire and fire safety. That's my job. You know, that's what I get paid to do. And I want the relationship between fire service officers and the public to stay the way it is, even though we're kind of venturing towards the definition of police officer. I don't think there's a lot of firefighters out there that would like to be confused. I think they'd like the public to be very clear exactly what they're there to do. And just because we're given the right to do citations or not, I don't think that should change the way that the public is going to be looking at fire service officers, many of whom aren't going to be doing any arresting, aren't going to be carrying any weapons, aren't going to have those kind of badges, and just don't want to be treated like police officers.
All right. Any other discussion? Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
All right. Call the roll as amendment number 2.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Reinbold.
No.
Representative Kopp.
No.
Representative Stutes.
No.
Representative Ledoux.
Yes.
And Representative Christ Tompkins.
No.
And Representative Chair Klayman.
No.
That's 2 yeas, 5 nays.
So by a vote of 2-5, Amendment Number 2 has failed. And we're past 3 by a good 20 minutes. So we had the idea we'd get to more things today, but I think we are out of time. We will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 21st at 1 p.m. On Wednesday, the committee will hear House Bill 328, Biometric Geolocation Info and Trade Practice, sponsored by my office, and Senate Bill 148, Background Checks for Police and Training, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. If anyone is considering an amendment to House Bill 75, Gun Violence Protective Order, sponsored by Representative Tarr, please might let my office know and submit them by 4 p.m. on Tuesday. I want to remind all committee members that amendments must be submitted by email. Anything hand-delivered, while welcome, is not considered timely for purposes of meeting the amendment deadlines. Any amendments must be submitted by email. I'd also like to remind committee members that the committee will not be meeting on Friday, March 23rd. We also have scheduled evening sessions on Wednesday, March 21st, and Thursday, March 22nd. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. It is 3:20 p.m.